Good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Jeff Mankoff with the Russian Eurasia program here at CSIS. And I have the privilege of welcoming to Washington and to CSIS our old friend Ivan Safranchuk, who's going to talk about Russian policy in Afghanistan. It's pretty clear that after 18 or so years, the US is interested in, if not entirely getting out, at least reducing its presence and its footprint in Afghanistan. In response to which, over the past couple of years, there's been a significant uptick in Russian political, diplomatic, and other kinds of activity. There's a lot of interest in Washington, I think, in understanding what Russia is doing in Afghanistan, what ultimately its aims are, but perhaps not as much understanding as would be ideal. So to hopefully fill in some of those gaps, I'm glad to welcome Ivan to join us today. Ivan is an associate professor at the Moscow City Institute of International Relations and at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow, and is a member of the Council on Foreign and Defense Policy. And I should also say that he is a non-resident senior associate with our program here at CSIS. He's an expert on Eurasia, Afghanistan, Central Asia, lots of other things. He was, from 2011 to 2014, deputy director at the Institute of Contemporary International Studies at the Russian Diplomatic Academy. He serves as an advisor to the Diplomatic Academy of Kyrgyzstan. He was a visiting fellow here, and he once headed the Moscow office of the Center for Defense Information. Worked at the Pierce Center, has been in a lot of different places and has done a lot of things, and is probably one of Russia's best known experts on Central Asia and Afghanistan. So he's gonna talk to us for half an hour, 45 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions afterward. We are on the record, we're being recorded, and if you haven't done so already, please turn off your cell phones and other noise-making devices. And with that.
Probably that refers also to me.
Yeah, let's be a good example for everybody.
Yeah. I forgot to do it myself. Thank you, Jeff, for this very kind introduction. It's always a pleasure for me to return to CSIS and to meet friends and colleagues here and more broadly in Washington. And of course, I'm very honored to address today this distinguished audience and share some of my views on the topic of our today meeting. I would start from something what I would not like you to take just for self-advertisement, but still I would refer to the report which you could collect at the entrance. That is the report which was prepared while I was staying for a few months with CSIS. And one of the major findings of the report was the thesis that the report was written in 2016 and it was published in 2017. The finding was that the central government of Kabul, that time and still headed by President Ghani, may face very unpleasant realities. The situation is that the central government of Kabul is the major owner of legitimacy in Afghanistan. That is the internationally recognized authority, and that is the major body of legitimacy. But that government is not effective enough, and that government is not strong enough to deliver security and economic development. I was making the thesis in that report that time may come when this dilemma between legitimacy and efficiency of the government, which has been traditionally in Afghanistan solved in favor of legitimacy, may be solved in a different way. So what if important players inside Afghanistan, but also around Afghanistan, regional governments around Afghanistan, at some point say, legitimate but incapable government is a problem. It is legitimate, that's why it doesn't authorize many things to happen. But it is incapable, that's why it cannot do many things on its own. So if it cannot do many things on its own, other people may take responsibilities, but they would not like to lack authorization from the legitimate but incapable government. So at some point, I was arguing in that report, the government may find out that support for this government is just collapsing. Nobody needs it because it is incapable. And nobody wants this weak, legitimate government to block efforts of others, to veto efforts of others. And I think that we are very close to that point. We see that the United States negotiate to the Taliban over the head of the Afghan government, the official government. We see that Moscow is talking to several different groups representing different parts of the Afghan society. The Afghan government, the official Afghan government, doesn't like it, criticizes it, but Russia is doing it respectively. irrespectively to what the central government is saying. We can also refer to efforts of regional powers around Afghanistan who growingly pay less and less attention to the opinion of the central government. So I think we are very much coming to that point when legitimacy without capability is not needed by anybody. Moreover, it becomes a problem. It contributes to problems. Because if you feel that you need to do something on your own, then you do not need somebody to veto or to criticize your doings from the position of legitimacy. That is my first thesis I want to share. So if 2 years or 3 years ago I was writing in that report that such moment may come, I think that it has arrived. We are at this point, and this is a sort of new reality for the Afghan internal politics, but also for regional affairs around Afghanistan. My second section is more on the Russian policy toward Afghanistan. And here I want to give a retrospective, which goes back for something like 15, maybe even 18 years ago. After the collapse of the Soviet Union and after withdrawal of the Soviet forces from Afghanistan, Russia wanted to do nothing with that part of the South. The Russian experience, the Soviet experience in Afghanistan was deemed to be absolutely negative. And the moods, the political and the public moods, could be summarized like, never again. We do not want to deal with Afghanistan or anything like Afghanistan. Our interests do not extend that far. However, in the 90s, when Russia was fighting Chechen insurgency, terrorist insurgency in the North Caucasus, in the territory of Russia itself, the understanding was common that instability spots in the southern Eurasia are somehow interconnected. For example, when Russia withdrew forces from Chechnya after the first Chechen War in 97, And Chechnya, under the name Ichkeria, became a de facto independent state. They established diplomatic relations with, guess whom, in the first turn, with the Afghan Emirate of Afghanistan, with the Emirate of Afghanistan, ruled that time by Taliban, soon in coalition with Al-Qaeda. The vice president of Ichkeria, Yandarbiev, visited Afghanistan and established diplomatic relations with the Taliban government. There was some exchange of fighters between them. Chechens started using Afghan camps. Some of Arabic fighters came from Afghanistan to Chechnya itself, like, for example, groups headed by Khattab, one of the most bloody figures in that war. And Russia was looking at all that as a sort of interconnection between different terroristic spots in the South Caucasus, in Central Asia, and also in Afghanistan. And by the end of the 90s, Russia was coming to the opinion that actually we cannot fight this part of terrorism, of international terrorism, only in the Northern Caucasus, without caring about what is happening in Afghanistan or in Central Asia. And because of this, their attention toward Afghanistan and the concern over Afghanistan was returning into the Russian foreign policy and security bureaucracies. So the position, never again we want to care about it, it lasted for about 10 years. And then by the end of the 90s, that position eroded. Russia was understanding that it had to take care of it. But of course, nobody wanted to take care of it militarily. Although some military means were not completely taken out of table. For example, in the year 2000, that time advisor to President Putin, Yastremski, he made public statements that Russia may need at some point to make strikes against Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But then, soon in a year after 9/11, another country decided to take care of Afghanistan and to bring stability and peace to that country. This is the United States. And for Russia, that was a sort of relief, because Russia was growingly thinking, as I just said, by the late 90s and early 2000 years, that we can't help but to think what is going on in Afghanistan. We need to pay attention to it, because they are connected to the Northern Caucasus, to Central Asia. So we will have to do something about it. And then the United States came and promised to eliminate terroristic elements in Afghanistan. And for Russia, that was actually the positive news. That's why Russia did not object in any way to the American intervention in Afghanistan. Moreover, those groups which cooperated in previous years with Russian government, with Indian government, with the Iranian government, the groups united under their common name Northern Alliance, which was supported exactly in the second half of the 90s by Russia, India, and Iran, all those groups helped the United States to intervene successfully into Afghanistan and to defeat the bulk of the open Talib forces very quickly by the end of the 2001. So Russia, if not welcomed the United States in Afghanistan, Then at least Russia was very much hoping that that the United States can bring peace and stability in Afghanistan and actually provide security not only for America and EU allies, but also for Russia. And that period lasted, I think, quite long, for about 5 years, maybe 4 or 5 years, till the mid 2000 years. Russia in that period fully trusted the United States to do their counter-terrorism, counter-insurgency job in Afghanistan. And Russia, I think, would sincerely, that time, I think Russia sincerely wished success to the American military operation in Afghanistan. Of course, many Russian experts did not believe that success was possible. Many Russian experts were skeptical, taking into account Russian or Soviet experience and taking into account the British experience in Afghanistan. Many Russian experts, narrow experts on Afghanistan, were saying that it's unlikely to fully succeed. But I would stress that this was skepticism that people did not believe this may happen. But it doesn't mean that people did not wish this to happen. The Russian official bureaucracies and most of the Russian community, I repeat, sincerely wished success to America in Afghanistan in the first half of the 2000 years. However, things shifted substantially after the concept of Greater Asia, Greater Central Asia, was introduced by Condoleezza Rice in 2005. Russia saw that if the United States achieved full success in Afghanistan, then provided peace, security, and stability would be used for connecting Central Asia, which Russia, if not officially, then on the expert level, many Russians take Central Asia as a sort of backyard. And so if security and stability is provided in Afghanistan, then America was saying with the Greater Central Asia strategy, this Russian backyard would be connected to the South Asia, which theoretically would give many new economic opportunities to Central Asia, but clearly this would diminish Russian economic and consequently political influence in the region. And when this was realized, Russian taking of the American operation in Afghanistan started being a phenomenon between two extremes. From the security perspective, Russia didn't want America to fail, because failure of America would mean return of full-scale terrorism bases in Afghanistan. And that would be a threat to Central Asia and to Russian allies to Central Asia, and maybe through Central Asia to Volga region and to the Northern Caucasus, the co-Russian territories. So from security perspective, Russia was still interested in America not failing. But at the same time, Russia was not any more interested in America fully succeeding. Because if fully secured, Afghanistan would become a connector, a hub between Central Asia and Afghanistan, and that would undermine Russian economic, geoeconomic, and geostrategic stakes in Central Asia. And Russia's position from the mid-2000 years started to exist between these two extremes. Russia was interested in America not to fail, because that would mean negative security consequences for Russia and Russian allies. But at the same time, Russia was not interested in America succeeding, because that would mean diminishing Russian influence in the Russian a sort of backyard in Central Asia. And This position existed through all the second half of the 2000 years. And this duality, this dualism in the Russian position was probably not very comfortable for the United States, because the United States always, American diplomats and American bureaucracies always look for ultimate friends and ultimate enemies. When somebody is okay on something with the United States, but not okay on something else with the United States, that is not very comfortable with for American bureaucracies, because you can't understand, is it really a friend or an enemy? And this duality in the Russian position, I think, this duality in the Russian position had negative effects on the possibility of Russian-American cooperation, because America did not fully trust the Russian position because of this duality. However, in the late 2000 years, Russian position further shifted. Russia was seen, and the Russian experts who predicted, who were skeptical from the very beginning and who predicted that the United States are unlikely to fully succeed, their predictions started to seem more and more relevant. And when the Obama administration came, and in February 2009, the first strategy toward Afghanistan was announced, it was read by many, despite the promise to increase troops, as the beginning of the withdrawal strategy. Because the increase of troops was promised just for a period of time to make withdrawal possible. And Russia had to start thinking about what if America drops Afghanistan off? What if America withdraws from this commitment to secure and stabilize Afghanistan? Inside the United States, the very popular opinion that time, both Holbrooke and Clinton were talking about it, was that more regional approach toward Afghanistan was needed. And Russia was understanding it in the way that regional voices will be more important. And in March 2009, right after Obama announced his first strategy, Russia gathered in Moscow a big conference on Afghanistan under the auspices of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And Shanghai Cooperation Organization is actually the best instrument, technically the best instrument, for a regional approach toward Afghanistan, because all neighbors of Afghanistan have some status with this organization. That time, Iran, except one country, except Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan doesn't have any status with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But all other neighbors of Afghanistan, immediate neighbors, and some of the extended neighbors of Afghanistan had some role in the organization. Either they were full members, or they were observers, or they had a third layer status, partner in dialogue. So Russia gathered that meeting on Afghanistan, a special conference on Afghanistan under the auspices of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and tried to forge some regional common understanding on the Afghan issues. Within the dynamics as they existed that time, a lot of emphasis was made on stressing that not only military means should be employed to bring good future to Afghanistan. But also more attention should be paid to economic development, in particular. And so at the turn of the of these decades, Russia realized, or Russian position further shifted, not only to understanding that Russia will need to pay attention to Afghanistan, but to understanding that maybe Russia will have to deal more with Afghanistan, more than Russia would like. And Russia would be forced to do it because of lack of American success. If America would have been more successfully, then Russia could trust the job to the United States. And we can see how between 2009, 2010, and 2014, maybe 2015, Russia started talking far more to all regional countries about Afghanistan. Even to those countries with whom traditionally Russian relations were not very good, like, for example, Pakistan. In all the same period, we saw that Russia-Pakistan relations were improving through all this decade. So Russia was talking about Afghan affairs to India, to Pakistan, to Iran, of course, to Central Asian, countries, and to China. And Russia was trying to understand different regional approaches to Afghanistan, regional dynamics, and all that theoretically should have helped to be more effective in that Afghan affairs without the United States, when and if the United States drop the mission. Of course, to some extent, different regional countries had different approaches to that. It happens in a little bit strange way that most of countries who are more friendly to the United States do not want the United States to leave Afghanistan, like, for example, India. And India in the first half of 2000 years did not believe that the United States would leave Afghanistan, despite even the Obama administration rhetorics. But countries who have some difficulties with the United States actually more welcome the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. This is Pakistan, first of all, but also China to some extent. Of course, for the United States, that must seem suspicious. That must look suspicious. When your friends want you to stay and your enemies want you to, not enemies, but your countries with whom you have difficulties want you to leave. I understand that for America it looks suspicious, but that is the reality. But Russia was having very sincere discussions with both these groups, with those who wanted America to leave and with those who wanted America to stay. And I would say that in this period, that period in the first half of the 2000 years was very important. Russia, I would summarize Russian position in that period as something like a position, I would say it is like being in a museum, when you want to see everything, but you do not touch anything. So Russia was understanding that events develop not exactly as the United States want, not exactly as somebody else wants, but internal dynamics are developing on their own, and we should know and understand more what is going on, and to understand it from first hands, from Afghans themselves, from neighbors of Afghanistan, and so on. So, and that's why I call it museum-like position. So Russia wanted to see everything and to understand everything, but not to get involved, not to be sucked by events, not to be forced to do anything. And Russia started talking to different Afghan politicians, to different groups in Afghanistan, to all Afghan neighbors, immediate and extended neighbors. And in that four or five years of that position, I think Russia regained a lot of expertise on Afghanistan and a lot of very deep understanding of the dynamics in Afghanistan. And I think that right now the Russian knowledge and understanding of Afghanistan is very good. Russia understands internal and regional dynamics around Afghanistan. The next milestone is probably not directly connected to Ukraine, but it happened in more or less the same time. This is 2014 and 2015. When the Russian-American relations moved in the direction of more and more tense confrontation, when Russia and the United States engaged in these sanctions and counter-sanctions dynamic, when Russia and the United States, when our views diverged on Syria, the Russian position in Afghanistan further shifted. I would say that Russia, from that period of time, wanted not only to see and understand everything, but also to gain or regain instruments of doing something. So that is something, how different it is from the first, from the previous position. In the previous position, as I said, you just want to understand, fully to have full understanding of why and how something something happens. In this new stage of position, you want also to understand how to influence events if necessary. So you want to understand which bottom you need to push to get what result. So you establish and reestablish instruments of policies, but not implying them so far. And I think that in the previous, in the last 4 years, Russia reestablished a lot of instruments and capabilities to do things in Afghanistan politically, not militarily, but politically, independently, without asking or without considering what the United States think about it. And this new reality, so the United States were always cautious on Russia having that museum-type position when Russia wanted to have independent knowledge on Afghanistan and independent understanding. But when Russia started to regain instruments of having influence on events in Afghanistan, America became even more cautious and very suspicious of what Russia was doing. And I think that by now, Russia, as I said, has instruments, political instruments for independent political behavior on the Afghan affairs, and in maybe to some extent even in Afghan politics. And now I want to bring these two theses together. Something what I started from. I started from saying that we come to the point when important Afghan groups, but also foreign governments, pay less attention to the central government of Afghanistan. And at the same time, we come to the point when not only the United States, but also other countries, regional countries, and also Russia, have instruments for independent policies in Afghanistan. So we are now in the period when different countries, because we speak about Russia and the United States only, or mostly, we can say Russia and the United States, can play in Afghanistan their own games. We are not yet at the point when we fight each other in Afghanistan or we directly confront each other in Afghanistan. And I want to stress it because that is very important. America is doing something in Afghanistan not to bring harm to Russia. That is not a counter-Russian policy. And Russia is doing something in Afghanistan not because of America. It's also not counter-US policy. But the United States want to achieve something. You always change mind when you want what you want to achieve, but the United States want to achieve something. And Russia thinks that Russia cannot trust the United States. Russia cannot trust the American capabilities in Afghanistan, but Russia also cannot trust American intentions in Afghanistan. And that is very important that Russia, as I said, before 10 years ago, Russia was concerned that America cannot secure Afghanistan. Now it's very important that Russia is suspicious about American intentions in Afghanistan. In the last 10 years, a lot of destabilization came to the northern regions of Afghanistan. Those regions of Afghanistan which neighbor Central Asia and Russia and the Russian ally, Tajikistan. And of course for Russia that looks suspicious. Why there is transit of insecurity, why there is transfer of insecurity from south and east of Afghanistan to the north, closer to the Central Asian and Russian borders. Some think that this is maybe not only the natural flow of events, but maybe America is actually behind it. And that question is already openly raised, and there is, as you know, probably in the Russian-American exchanges on Afghanistan, there is the issue of unknown helicopters, unidentified helicopters, which allegedly bring weapons and fighters from east and south of Afghanistan to the north of Afghanistan. And of course, in the Russian view, only the country which is fully aware of what is going on in the American in the Afghan air zone. Only that country may know whose helicopters can be there. So Russia hints that the United States is behind it. And so we are now at the point when we do not confront each other in Afghanistan, but we behave independently in Afghanistan. And at the same time, we do not care much about the central government. It looks like a very good ground for new destabilization and for new disorder in this country. I would also make the comparison, which I don't know how often you come across such comparison, but still, the comparison between Afghanistan and Syria. To some extent, these are mirror situations. The United States are militarily present in Afghanistan and have the commitment to stabilize this country with full support from the legitimate local government. But Russia is present in Afghanistan independently politically. And the United States think that Russia may impede American efforts in Afghanistan. In Syria, we have Russia militarily present in Syria with full cooperation with the local, internationally recognized and legitimate government of Assad. And we have America, bluntly speaking, illegally present in Syria, contrary to the international law and contrary to the opinion of the local government. And Russia believes that America makes the Russian job of securing Syria more complicated and more difficult. And to some extent, these are mirror situations, except that America is present in Syria militarily, and Russia, as I said, is present in Afghanistan indirectly, more politically. And that very much contributes to the distrust which we have in our relations. When I make this comparison to Syria, I do not mean in any way that some exchanges are possible. But I just want to stress with this comparison that the Afghan situation cannot be taken per se. When Russian bureaucracies and Russian politicians look at the Afghan situation, they look at it in broader context of international relations, of American policies in different parts of the region. And of course, when the United States, when American experts or American diplomats make the point that Russia may impede American policies or policies of the Afghan government, of course, the question pumps up. And what about Syria? Why you care about weak government in Afghanistan, and you want to secure and to defend that weak government in Afghanistan, the central government? And you do not care about at all about the central government of Syria, the internationally recognized government of Assad. Why you want to defend some guys in Afghanistan to defend them in office, and why you want to take away other guys out of the office in the other country? Of course, there are many explanations why the situation is different. And I don't want to go into that discussion, who is right and who is wrong in those exchanges. I'm just saying that for many years, in Russia and in the United States, there was the prevailing view that Afghanistan is a very special case. We may disagree somewhere, we may have many divergences on many issues, but in Afghanistan, there is commonality of basic views. And Afghanistan may be an area of cooperation, even if things are very bad in other parts of our relations. I don't think it is true anymore. That is, of course, my expert opinion. I do not express the Russian government or the Russian bureaucracies in any way. But as far as I evaluate events, I understand that Afghanistan is not taken anymore as a special case for our relationship. It is taken in broader context. It is compared to Syria. It is compared to American policies in other parts of the world. And probably that is also a negative. That is very likely also to have negative effects on the future developments in Afghanistan. So coming all these elements together, I would like to summarize the central point I am making with repeating that Afghan central government did not became strong and capable enough to support its legitimacy, and now all international players care less about the central government. But at the same time, key international players, the United States and Russia first of all, are capable to pursue independent policies in Afghanistan. It's very likely that we will do it So far, we do it not in confrontation to each other, but in some sort of competition to each other. In the future, however, we may easily slip toward more direct play against each other in Afghanistan. That cannot be fully excluded. But that is not a reality. That is not a reality so far. Here I stop, and I'm open for your questions.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Very informative and I think provocative. Hopefully we should have a good discussion. Let me just start with one question before we kick it off. And that is, assuming the U.S. does decide that it doesn't want to stay in Afghanistan anymore, which seems to be an increasingly likely possibility, what is Russia's objective going to be at that point?
Objective in Afghanistan without the United States present in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
The Russian objective would not be very much different from what it is now. The objective would be to prevent open civil war in the country by helping Afghans to maintain their politics within political instruments. And Russia was saying it several times, that Russia wants to maintain political process in Afghanistan. America may be in Afghanistan or out of Afghanistan. Different Afghan groups may be part of the Afghan government. But inside Afghanistan, disagreements between different Afghan groups are very serious. And the worst what may happen for neighbors of Afghanistan, at least for most of neighbors of Afghanistan, is that all these inside Afghan disputes take the military form. That's why Russian objective is to maintain political process in Afghanistan. Russia is not committed, as far as I understand. Maybe I'm wrong, but I understand that Russia is not committed to economic prosperity of Afghanistan. Russia is not committed to making Afghanistan a great mining power, like some other countries promised to Afghanistan, or like the World Bank report of 2015 promised to Afghanistan in 10 years of transition, after 10 years of transition. Russia is not committed to any big promises which were delivered to Afghanistan by others, by the United States, by the international community, by Europeans, by the World Bank with their report of 10 years of transition. Russia is committed to curbing open civil war. That is probably a very narrow objective, and probably that does not fully meet the interests of Afghans, who received a lot of promises from different countries. And if Afghans would take Russia responsible for those promises, that would be a mistake. Russia, as far as I understand, does not feel committed to deliver what was promised by others. What is Russia? That's why, to sum up, the Russian objective is just to maintain the political process so that internal disputes do not take military forms.
Okay, great. Let's open it up to questions. We have a microphone in the back, so please wait to be recognized. And Cyrus will bring you the microphone. When you get the microphone, please identify yourself, please be brief, and please ask a question, which is a statement that ends in a question mark. Up here.
Hi, my name's Aaron Rabinowitz from George Washington University. I was wondering specifically if you're saying, and you've mentioned several times, that Russia is not committed to supporting the central government of Afghanistan, but if the objective is overall to maintain the political process, would you say that detente with other insurgency groups, in particular the Taliban, is the central strategic focus, or are there other political processes that Russia is aiming to maintain overall towards that goal?
The major instrument which is used so far, that was the instrument of the Moscow format. And there were meetings of the Moscow format last year. The central government of Kabul was not supportive of those meetings. However, if other groups, non-governmental groups, and some of these people were part of the government or are part of the government, even if they do not represent at these meetings the government directly, if they want to talk to each other and they want to use this platform and this dialogue, why not? The central government of Kabul always wanted to do everything through the central government of Kabul, to provide security through the central government of Kabul, to provide economic development through the central government of Kabul. Probably you remember well, 10 years ago, what a big fight was between those who wanted to channel international aid directly to regional authorities in Afghanistan and those who were arguing that all international aid should be channeled through the central government. Finally, it was channeled through the central government. What was the result? The result was more the growing level of corruption in that government and its patronage networks, rather than the efficiency of the use of that aid. The same with security. There was a very important pressure on the central government in autumn of 2015, after Kunduz was captured in October 2015, and it was occupied by the Taliban and their allies for what, something like 2 weeks. And the question was raised, if the central government cannot defend regional capitals, maybe more responsibilities should be given to regional militias? The answer from Ghani, from the president, was no. Something like security of Afghanistan is indivisible. Security, no more role for regional militias, the central government will play the role. But if you cannot exercise the power, you should share it. Otherwise, nobody finally cares about it. And that's what I started from, and I think we're coming to that point. And I want to draw your attention to the subtitle of the report which we offered to you. The subtitle is Toward Dividing Insecurity. I think we were in the period in 2000 years when everybody wanted to share security. But if it comes to insecurity, people want to divide it. So security, everyone wants to have common security. If you have security, I want you to share that security with me, and I want to share your security with myself. But if there is insecurity, people want to divide it. And we come to that point. From sharing security, we come to the mindset of dividing insecurity. Coming back to your question, the major instrument is the Moscow format, and the slightly new format which we have these days to yesterday and tomorrow in Moscow. That is when Afghans, different Afghans, met in Moscow, not under the auspices of the Russian MFA, so this meeting was organized by the Afghan diaspora in Russia, not by the Afghan government. So that is the instrument. to provide opportunities for them to speak and to decide something. People from the government, people outside of the government. But if people from the government do not want to participate in that, okay, then others talk between them. Is it allowed to people to talk without government, including on important issues? Probably yes.
Okay.
I'm Harlan Ullman with the Atlantic Council. Let me challenge your hypothesis, if I can. Russia has had, or the Soviet Union has such a bad time, as you point out, in Afghanistan, that reemerging for altruistic reasons seems to me to be rather far-fetched. And in my discussions with some very, very senior Russian leaders, it strikes me that Putin's ulterior motive here is not only to reduce America's influence, but also NATO's. Don't forget, it's the NATO coalition that's in Afghanistan. And the more that Putin can do to reduce the influence of that coalition, it seems to me contributes to its larger purpose of trying to sow dissent among the alliance in Europe. Could you comment on that?
If I understood you correctly, you think that Putin is trying to undermine America and NATO in Afghanistan. As I said before, Russian position in the second half of the previous decade was between wishing not ultimate American defeat, because that would mean insecurity, more insecurity, and not wishing ultimate American success, because that would mean opening venues for implementation of the greater Central Asia vision, and that would undermine Russian interests, economic and geostrategic interests in Central Asia. I would add another element to that. In the very late 2000 years, when Russian-American relations became already quite tense, Russia was not against America bleeding in Afghanistan. So if you have problems, your own problems, and you stay, you remain committed, but you cannot achieve what you want, so you stay and bleed, I think Russia was not against it. But keeping hands clear, like, not, we did not do it. You did it yourself. Maybe we did not help you enough, but that is another issue. So I would paraphrase what you say, and then I would agree with that, that Russia has some moral satisfaction seeing the United States and NATO allies failing. But as far as I understand, Russia keeps hands away from it. Like, Russia is not contributing to that. Russia is not doing it. But Russia has some satisfaction seeing this happening. Does it answer your question?
Well, I don't agree entirely. I think that Russia has more than a simple passive rationale, and I think Russia is more engaged, not only being unhelpful, but taking certain steps in supporting the Taliban. This conference that is being held in Moscow, for example, is diabolically clever on the part of Putin. To embarrass Zal's, or not necessarily to embarrass, but to parallel what Zal Kelizad is trying to do. And I don't see Russian intentions, nor if I were in Russia's position, to be quite as benign as you're presenting. Because I think it's in Russia's interest to do what it can to demean and diminish the role of NATO in the United States. And I don't see why being perfectly passive is the right answer. We certainly would not be.
Russia was the last of all important countries to start talking to Taliban. Actually, the Russian position through most of the 2000 years was that Taliban is not a partner for dialogue. Taliban is something you need to defeat, because Taliban is an internationally recognized terroristic group. They are in the UN, various UN terrorist lists. Who decided to talk to Taliban? Some European diplomats, some British diplomats, UN diplomats. Some UN diplomats were very optimistic about talking to Taliban. And finally, the United States, under the Obama administration, yes, decided to also to look for some opportunities of contacts with Taliban. The Germans talked to Taliban. The Norwegians, that's what was reported in the press. Various contacts to Taliban were reported. Maybe you remember 10 years ago, there was a Pickering Brahimi report, which openly argued for negotiations. So in 10 years, most of the neighbors of Afghanistan talked to Taliban, Americans talked to Taliban, Europeans talked to Taliban, even reportedly some German, Japanese people talked to Taliban. And Russia was saying, okay, if the Afghan government thinks that it is necessary to reconcile with them, it's your internal issue, do it. But we do not support deals with Taliban. Russia was the last to start talking to Taliban. And when Russia started talking to Taliban, all those who started talking to Taliban before Russia said, this is wrong. Do you think that can be in any way taken positively in Russia? If you say that the Moscow format impedes Khalilzad negotiations, but actually the Moscow format started before the Khalilzad mission. How that may impede the Khalilzad mission if the Khalilzad mission started after the Moscow format? Then, you know, Moscow may say that the Khalilzad mission is impeding the Moscow format, but Russia is not saying it. Khalilzad had meetings in Moscow with the special representative Kabulov, and as far as I heard, he was... Khalilzad was not negative on that meeting. So I think you over exaggerate how much Russia impedes American not enough American success in Afghanistan. I can agree. That as I was trying to show in my presentation, that from being fully committed to American success, Russia shifted to not being committed to American success in Afghanistan. But that is far from actively and directly impeding American policies. So the only example you made, that the Moscow format impedes Khalilzad mission, that is not the reality, at least because the Khalilzad mission started before the Moscow format was established.
Okay.
Kathy Cosman, I was hoping you could say something more about the situation of large ethnic minorities, which of course have their brethren across the border, i.e. Uzbeks, of course Tajiks, and also Turkmen, and also the degree to which they are involved in the Taliban, directly or indirectly.
In all this 17 years of American presence in Afghanistan, the ethnic issue was something what people preferred not to talk about. It was put aside. However, inside Afghanistan, that continues to be an issue. I would put it in this way. When there are political opportunities to address issues which are important for different communities, not through ethnic lines, but through some other political mechanisms, people forget about ethnic divisions and contradictions. But if other instruments do not work, people mobilize on the ethnic basis. Look at the example of 2014 elections, presidential elections. The first round of those elections was not ethnic at all. All candidates had their ticket, other ethnicities on their ticket. The only exception, or half exception, was Karzai, was Ghani himself, because he had Tajik and he had Uzbek and Hazara, but not Tajik. On all other presidential tickets, there was one at least one Tajik. And the first round of those elections did not touch upon ethnic issues. People talked about various issues not through ethnic lines. What was in the second round between Ghani and Dr. Abdullah? All mobilization started working for the second round through the ethnic issue was very important for the mobilization of vote for the second round. Pashtun nationalistic networks and patronage networks were used to mobilize vote for Ghani. And an important argument, not for Abdullah himself, but for his camp, for people who wanted to support him, was to resist the threat, maybe exaggerated, but still the threat, the perceived threat of Pashtunization. Because, as I said, nationalistic Pashtun networks were very active mobilizing vote for Ghani in the second round. So when other political instruments failed, in the end it comes to the ethnic issue. That's the bottom instrument of mobilization when other instruments fail. And that issue is growingly important. Another dimension which I would bring in answer to this question is that in the past, there was a sort of thinking that regional figures, regional power brokers, want to have less power of Kabul on them. And the idea was that an effective central government may be effective only if its power reaches all regions of the country. And that was promotion of the importance of the central government. And to some extent, that was successful. But what became the unexpected consequence of that? The unexpected consequence of that became that regional power brokers decided that if all the power is in Kabul, we should go to Kabul and become part of that power. And actually, the disagreement between the center and the region all shifted into the center, into the Kabul government itself. And everyone is fighting for the Kabul government. It becomes Kabul. So the government itself becomes not the source of stability, but the source of disagreement and huge internal conflict in the government. And that is a descending negative dynamic which nobody expected. People were thinking, okay, we make a central powerful government, it reaches power everywhere, and things work. No way. It didn't happen. Something different happened. People came to Kabul and said, okay, now we want to be part of this government. And the reality is that nobody in Afghanistan can win decisively. That's the country of minority. What happens? To win elections, you need to make a coalition. And then when coalition is established, it wins elections, and then it starts confrontation inside the coalition for the redistribution of resources to which they together got access, because they need that those resources to support their patronage networks. So the central government paradoxically became the source of conflict at this stage. It's instead of becoming the source of legitimate and positive power as it was expected. So that ethnic issue shifted from center versus regional dimension to the conflict in Kabul, in the central government itself. And now I think some people would prefer let these important regional power brokers spend more time and effort in regions, but they don't want, because they know that all the power is in Kabul. And the reality is that also nobody in Afghanistan is ready to leave somebody, some other forces in power unattended for 4 years. People think that, no. We, like for example, democracy works here in the United States. Yeah, well, maybe not with this president, because he is not left unattended in power, people attack him. But the idea is that somebody who wins power can exercise that power for 4 years, and then new elections, and he may lose power, he or she may lose power. In Afghanistan, those important groups, they think that, no, we cannot allow our rivalries to win without us. So first we need to force them to include us into coalition. And then when we are together in that coalition government power, we become an internal, an inter-coalition confrontation or competition or struggle, maybe more right word. That how it happens. The idea would be now probably to push people out of Kabul, to downsize the conflict, but everyone sticks to Kabul because that's where the money is. Most of that money is American.
Okay. Thank you, sir. As I spoke with you before your presentation.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Nowadays, sorry. My name is Nasim. I work for Voice of America, a TV reporter. In the past 2 days, there were a conference of Afghan former politicians and Taliban. Even when Taliban were in power, as you said also, Russia was supporting the Northern Alliance. What has changed now that they are siding with Taliban or promoting them in front of the Kabul government? As Ghani said in his long 1 hour interview that our relation with the rest of the world is known. This is a legitimate government through the election. We have relation with other countries based on international laws, but Taliban has relation with Al-Qaeda and some other groups that are known as Daesh and some others. So what can Russia get from these conferences and political support they offer?
Russia can get continuation of different Afghan groups talking to each other instead of fighting each other. They talk, they find some solutions, some compromises. That is maintenance of the political process, as I already said. And it is very important to maintain political process. I understand that some people want to say, okay, all stay away, I just fix now everything, and if everybody supports it, everything is going to be fine. But Nothing in life happens like that. People have different views. People represent their views. If their views are not taken into account, some people may even fight. In Afghanistan, that is possible. Taliban is the example. They fought for their views. I think that it is very important in Afghanistan to make more or less transparent deals between different groups. Do people know what, for example, Khalilzad is speaking to Taliban about? What are conditions? People say these are important negotiations. They will bring peace. They will bring peace on what conditions? Who knows these conditions? Who authorized these conditions? Whose interests these conditions represent? Former Northern Alliance people, do they know about these conditions? Even Ghani probably does not know fully about these conditions. He was, it seemed that in the end of the previous year, he was also a little bit concerned with what is the Khalilzad mission and what it is to achieve. In contrast to that, Moscow format is more transparent. Different Afghans meet and talk to each other, and then they tell each other to their patronage networks, to their partners, what they discussed. We are not in the several attempts to bring, how it was identified, government in a box, yes? To bring some solution, and look, guys, that is a good solution, accept it. The level of consciousness and the level of representation of interests is such in Afghanistan that people will not necessarily accept it. And that's why I'm not against Khalilzad mission at all. I think that is important to try to bring some peace and to negotiate some political solution to all this long war, but it's better to be done on the terms which are known by important political figures in Afghanistan, rather than imposed on them. Moscow format allows different Afghan groups, all those who want to be represented, are represented there. It's not that some people were denied representation. Some didn't want to be represented. Some were forced by others not to go, but that is a different case. Most of the important groups in Afghanistan were and continue to be represented in the Moscow format, and that makes political reconciliation more transparent and probably in the future more sustainable, rather than just bringing a good solution, the terms of which become good or bad news for people.
Okay, in the back.
Yeah, I'm Ken Meyercord. Has Russia ever been concerned about the burgeoning of the opium trade consequent to the American occupation? As I understand about it, a lot of that opium ends up in Russia.
Yes, I did not mention the drug issue at all. And for Russia, it was always a very important issue. But I think it was very important in the 2000 years in the sense that with the American presence, the production of opium was not reduced. On the contrary, the production was increasing. And of course, it was another reason for Russia to think that the United States do not take into account enough the Russian concerns and interests. However, and the drug issue continues to be, of course, important because trafficking continues and drug consumption is a big issue inside Russia. But I think that political issues at the moment overtake overtake the drug issue. When it is about war and political reconciliation, it doesn't mean that people do not care about drugs, but it becomes a sort of secondary issue for a while. But yes, that is a very important issue because the production of drugs was continuing in Afghanistan and the transit toward Russia was also increasing. We had for a while very important, very active disputes how the drug issue was should be addressed. Those disputes were mostly in the late 2000 years, when the United States was saying that the problem is mostly on the, so Russia was saying that the problem is on the side of production. So let's address the problem in Afghanistan. Afghans themselves were saying, no, the problem is on the side of consumption. So do something at home, in Europe, in America, in Russia. And the United States was saying the problem is on the side of transit. So actually it means do something in Russia yourself, because transit goes through Russia and also through Central Asia. But then, by the way, we found a compromise for those positions. And for a while, the compromise was that the core of the problem should be drug mafia. And in late, what it was, 2012, yes, in October 2012, I think it was one of the last days of October 2012, Russia, the United States, the American Special Forces, with some participation of Russians in that team, conducted joint counter-drug operation in Afghanistan. And by the way, the Karzai government at that time was extremely unhappy about it.
It was earlier than 2012, but yeah.
It was October 2012.
I think it was earlier, but it doesn't matter.
Okay. No, I think it was the autumn. Then several more operations happened. There are different reports how many. Different reports give different number, but probably it was something like 10 or 12 operations totally. But then we lost that compromise. But I think actually it was a good compromise, because if we cannot decide what is the core of the problem, consumption, production, or transit, the laboratories themselves, where poppies become opium, that is something what we can agree. That, yeah, let's together do something about mafia, which makes opium from poppies. I think it was a good compromise, but it did not last long.
Okay.
Sabib Zadeh from Voice of America. As I understand you correctly, you said that the Afghan central government should share the security with the militia groups if it cannot provide the security for the whole country. So Afghanistan had that experience before, even during the Najibullah's government and after the Russian forces withdrawal from Afghanistan, when different Mujahideen groups entered Afghanistan and Afghanistan went into a civil war. So now Russia is hosting the same groups in Moscow and the Taliban as well. It seems that Russia is not supporting or is not supportive of a powerful central government in Afghanistan. And Afghans are fearing that they may enter again into a civil war if another government, interim government, is established or the current government of Afghanistan fails. So it seems that the Russian is not supportive of a strong central Afghan government, which is completely in contradiction with what the U.S. wants in Afghanistan.
What is in contradiction with what the United States wants?
Well, the United States obviously wants a strong, powerful central government in Afghanistan.
And that's why Khalilzad talks to Taliban.
And that's a separate issue. That's an issue of
it's a separate
peace.
Issue.
And does it concern
Russia?
Which
the central government cannot provide.
I'm sorry. Doesn't well, you know that you said that nobody knows about the details of Mr. Khalilzad's negotiations with Taliban doesn't concern Russia. And that's why Russia inviting Taliban as well to Moscow to get into negotiations somehow with the Taliban, so to find out what Mr. Khalilzad is talking about with the Taliban.
I repeat that Moscow format started before the Khalilzad mission. So to say that Moscow format was established to impede Khalilzad's work is just logically inaccurate. But the Moscow format started before the Khalilzad mission. I don't think that they are fully contradictory. I think they address the same problem from different sides through different diplomatic instruments. I don't understand why you want to antagonize them. It refers to your question and also to the earlier question. Why you want to antagonize the Moscow format and the Khalilzad mission? They address the same issue, how to stop war, which is unwinnable. Is the war winnable? Can the central government, with all the support of the United States, win the war against insurgency? Probably not. Do you think that anybody has the privilege to be the only one who can negotiate non-military solutions? Probably different countries can do it. If Afghans accept it themselves, why not? Are Afghans forced to come to Moscow? They are invited, and they want to come. Are they forced by Moscow to come? Are they forced to that table in Moscow? No. They want to talk to each other. Why not to give them such an opportunity? And I think that at this point, it is absolutely counterproductive to antagonize the Moscow format and the Khalilzad mission. I think the Khalilzad mission can actually benefit to some extent from the Moscow format. And I'm a little bit theorizing now, but I would say that Moscow format, because that is, you know, such a talking format, different people come and talk. It's unlikely, in my view, maybe Russian diplomats would say that I am wrong, but in my view, it does not promise quick solution. Like people quickly come to some agreement. Probably the Khalilzad mission, probably Ambassador Khalilzad can be quicker in negotiating something. But the problem in Afghanistan is not to make a good deal. The problem is to make that deal acceptable by enough people so that the deal lasts and is sustainable. There is no problem to bring a government in the box, to unpack it and have it working for a week. Probably there is not a big problem about it. The problem is how long will it last? And that's why I would see the right sequence or the right composition of these formats is that Khalilzad, Ambassador Khalilzad, achieves some result. And the Moscow format helps to make that result acceptable to the Afghan groups and sustainable and long-lasting. Once again, that is my expert opinion. And I was trying to stress in my presentation that at the moment we are at the point when people behave independently. But not in confrontation to each other. And that's why I'm a little bit surprised to see in your questions some already slipping, from my point of view, too early to taking things in antagonistic and confrontational terms. I think we should not antagonize Ambassador Khalilzad's mission and the Moscow format.
So just on that, you know, I would say, and this gets back to the earlier question, but there's a larger context to all of this with regard to U.S.-Russian relations, and it's not just about the future of Afghanistan, but it's about the future dynamic between the U.S. and Russia and how things in Syria and in Ukraine and in other parts of the world are reflected through the negotiations in Afghanistan. But that's kind of a bigger point. So it's in the back, yeah?
Thank you very much. My name is Sanjar Kamilev. I'm a Russian service of Voice of America. And could you please kindly tell us about, have you heard anything about Russia and Iran, you know, giving arms to Taliban? Because I think last year there been a huge rumors about that. And how could you possibly see from, you know, arming Taliban against U.S. and coalition forces, and now Moscow is trying to facilitate their own agenda, I mean, the negotiation. Thank you.
I'm sorry, what was the connection between the first part that Russia allegedly armed Taliban and the Russian efforts to facilitate peace process? How you connected it? I missed it.
First question was, do you know anything about this?
Yeah, I
you know?
Yeah.
And what was the like step from giving arms to Taliban and now inviting them and all Afghans, including government, to Moscow to negotiate? What was the step from your like analytical point of view? Thank you.
I think I cannot give you any analytical point of view about it, because your suggestion to find an element of chain between something unknown and something known. I know about Russia supplying something to Taliban, not more than you. Maybe you know more, but I know only what was reported and what was denied by Russia. And I've never heard this to be confirmed by the Taliban. So the peace process, that is something what we know. I can't link it, because I know very little about the first part of your question. But can you link fighting Taliban and then negotiating to Taliban? Can you link having Taliban in the terrorist list and then negotiating to that? So what is an analytical answer to that? It happens. It happens. You know the phrase.
Okay, we are running out of time. I think if you had a question you wanted us to follow up, let's take that, and then we have to finish.
Thank you. My follow-up question, I introduced myself before, Nassim from Voice of America. The follow-up question is that you said that why you guys antagonize the Moscow intentions, or one of the reasons that I can think of, even when the Taliban were on power, Russia was supporting Northern Alliance, General Dostum and former Massoud. So, and then Russia's relation with Pakistan was not good, of course, when they were supporting the withdrawal or the fighting against Soviets. And all of a sudden now, the Taliban become like the darling of Iran and Russia, while U.S. is supporting Afghan government in Afghanistan, which I will still say that at least in a country like Afghanistan, there was election and there is a parliament. It's true that the government doesn't have economical capability and military, but still, after the withdrawal of U.S. troops and NATO for the past couple of years, Afghan troops are fighting. So all of a sudden, this thing, is it Russia's motive? Because Russia, before that, when there was nothing in Afghanistan except there was a regime and they supported a coup against the king who was very friendly toward Russia because, and is it they are turning back to their old motives or there are some new motives due to the changes in strategic circumstances? This is the reason that we were asking. It's not the antagonism or anything else. We just want to know how can this dramatic change come? Is it because of
the change in attitude towards the Taliban?
The change of attitude toward the Taliban, I don't know, maybe for some people it is voluntary because they always like Taliban and they didn't like that Taliban was antagonized. Actually, in the United States, there were pro-Taliban voices in late 90s, even in 2000 year. Even shortly before 9/11, there were people in the United States who were arguing that actually Taliban is good, or at least better than the civil war. There was all this narrative, which started from Pakistan and very quickly proliferated in the United States, that the Taliban represents order, maybe wrong order, but order, after the disorder of the civil war in the beginning of 90s, when Massoud and Hikmatyar were destroying Kabul with artillery exchanges. I think all that narrative is wrong. That is the flawed narrative. Even if some people sincerely believed it, that's self-deception. The Taliban did not bring order to after that civil war disorder. The Taliban brought further antagonization, the emergence of Northern Alliance, increase of that ethnic issue, and it becomes an existential fighting between Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns. So I think all that narrative was flawed. But still, some people in the United States sincerely argued for that. Oh, not sincerely, but still argued for that. Russia was always very critical on Taliban, and probably Russia was critical even when already the US diplomats were asking not to be that critical. Russia was still critical on Taliban. But if the only force which was fighting Taliban, the American forces, withdrew the mission, and already Obama said in his first strategy in February 2009 that the objective in Afghanistan is not fighting against Taliban, it is fighting against Al-Qaeda. And only those parts of Taliban who are directly supportive of Al-Qaeda. So if there is no commitment to fight the Taliban, if the insurgency is growing, you say that the Afghan forces after 2015 fought the Taliban, yes, they fought, but with what losses? At what expense? How much the rotation of troops increased? Each year, the Afghan army loses something like one-third of the personnel, which escapes the army. And new guys need to be taken into the army. How all that is sustainable? The Taliban nearly doubled their control in 2 years. Of course, when we say doubled, that is from very low numbers. they control something like 6% of population, 10% of territory, more than 6% of population. The government now controls something like 65% of population. And Taliban controls, it doesn't control all the others. So I will not now go into these figures not to be mistaken, but the government controls about 65% of population. 65. And 2 years ago, control was far, far more. So Taliban is on the rise, but the government is not in full collapse, but it's not capable to stop the wave of growing Taliban control. So if nobody is fighting Taliban anymore, what to do? Either to talk the job on yourself, that is something Russia is not going to do, or to start talking to everyone, including to those people whom previously you didn't want to talk about. That is not more contradictory than shifting from fighting somebody to talking to somebody.
I think that's a very good place to end on. This has been really informative. Thank you very much. Let's all give
you thank you for your attention.